Hello, and welcome to Seedheads, the cross-pollinating podcast where our Canadian seed heroes tell their stories, share their how-to tips, and talk about the seeds they love. I'm your host, Steph Benoit, coming to you from Ottawa, Ontario, on the traditional unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabeg people. We have a really fun episode for you today. I recently had the chance to talk to two seed growers who are working on a collaborative northern watermelon breeding project. Evelisa McElfatrick is a seed and vegetable grower and the owner-operator of Root Cellar Gardens near Thunder Bay, Ontario, which is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe. It is now also the treaty territory of the Fort William First Nation, signatories to the Robinson-Superior Treaty of 1850. Manish Kushwaha is a seed grower and owner of Gaia Organic Seeds in Ottawa, Ontario, on the traditional territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe people. For the past few years, Evelisa and Manish have been working with growers across Ontario to develop a delicious, reliable watermelon that thrives in northern Ontario. In this episode, we talk about landrace breeding, the 22-variety watermelon cross that started it all, making breeding and seed saving more accessible, connecting to nature through plant breeding, the search for the elusive mango melon, and so much more. Talking with Evelisa and Manish really energized my passion for this topic. I hope you also enjoy their infectious enthusiasm and love for what they do. Thanks for listening.
Manish, I'm so excited to come in. I guess it's like next week, actually, week and a half. Because remember, I took that picture. I was like, this one's going to be the mango melon.
That row is growing, has lots of watermelons. I'm hoping like they are 2 weeks. So in 2 weeks, maybe like they'll get big enough that they are harvestable, you know. So.
Oh my gosh, I hope. I hope you have really warm days and nights until then.
Fingers crossed. I'm excited.
Totally. I can't wait to see. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you both for making the time to be here this evening. It's so great to have you both on the call and so excited about this project and coming with so much energy and so much enthusiasm. It's really, really a treat.
It's super fun to get to be here, Steph. Thanks for being curious about this.
Yeah, thank you, Steph. I'm very excited to talk about watermelon and share all these stories.
Yeah, and you both already started before I even hit record. You were sharing information or like you were catching each other up on how each of your watermelons are doing. So can we first start with like a little, how is everyone's watermelon patch doing right now? Recording here in early September.
Well, my watermelons are all harvested. We got really close to frost, maybe 4 or 5 nights ago. It didn't actually hit, but I pulled everything just in case because it was looking like it was going to be really cold. And the harvest was great. We had a cool summer, but the melons still managed to produce. Yeah, and so far so good. They've been super tasty, like some new disease problems popping up, but overall things were great. And they're so diverse. I just love the difference in all of them.
Did the sweetness change from last year?
You know, I think that they're maybe on the whole slightly less sweet this year.
Okay, I see.
And I'm guessing that that's maybe just because of the cold yeah. nights and cooler mm-hmm. weather. But not to say we haven't had some super sweet ones.
My watermelons, I just checked like a few days ago and everything is full of watermelons, all the patches. I have like maybe 6 places where I have watermelons and the main patch where I have watermelons from Eva and from Catherine and from myself, and that one is full of watermelons. And I was tracking the history of like which one is doing the best, and I did like a approximate count. Eva, your has the most amount of watermelons, and they are bigger in size as compared to other ones. So this is very exciting because taking your watermelons where you have adapted to your climate and then bringing it back here and then seeing like what is the how it would do, and it is performing best. And like this is like my dream to be able to like re-grow like watermelons from different places and see what the effect is. So it's in some ways amazing to see that yes, my intuitions of like yes, it will perform well, and it makes me even more excited that like regrow in different climatic zones, different same species, same varieties, to see the benefit of like what it can produce and do.
Oh my gosh, yeah, I'm very excited. Very excited to hear that there is a lot of success coming from both of your fields. Evelisa, I was hoping that you could sort of take us back. We got right into it, but take us back and tell us a little bit about the inspiration for this project and why you became interested in growing a cold tolerant sort of northern growing variety of watermelon.
It kind of comes back to just how I've been, and I still do, think a lot about resilience and regionally adapted seed. Had been, and still am, super curious about seed breeding. And I heard this great interview with a land-raised breeder named Joseph Loftos, who has had a lot of success kind of developing and working with land races in his climate in Utah, which is really challenging for vegetable production. Just hearing him describe the process he went through, and kind of, I'd never even heard of land race breeding. So hearing a bit about what that was, I loved the idea. It sounded like something I could try myself. And that might really work for our climate, which is really not necessarily one that seeds are typically bred for. We have really short seasons, typically cooler nights, even if we get some warm temperatures in the summer. And watermelon specifically had been a crop that I would love to grow, but had never had consistent result with, despite having tried a bunch of varieties. So I heard that interview and I thought about the watermelons and I thought this might be really fun. And that's kind of where the grain began.
And then Manish, how did you get involved early on?
Yeah, so I was growing watermelon on my own. I had like few varieties I was growing just to grow. This was like beginning of my seed journey. And it was 2019 when I planted like maybe 7 different kinds of watermelon. Then somebody else was doing watermelon as well. They shared some of their seeds that they had requested from Gene Bank in US and some from other growers in the region. And so overall, I had 22 varieties of watermelon growing that season. I just like saved the seeds from that population. The inspiration was I have always been growing like different diversity of watermelons. I wanted to like see what it will give me, like in terms of like, because I had these like diverse genes from different shapes, different size, different color, different tastiness. And I just wanted to see like what it will do next generation. For me, it was mostly curiosity and learning about seeds more, you know. And then we went to, me and Eva met at EFAO conference. It was Rebecca who introduced us to both of us, because we were talking about watermelon. It was like a seed meeting to talk about different varieties or things. So,
yeah, Rebecca said, you two talk to each other. Just crossed a ton of watermelons. And Ev, you want to start a watermelon land race. And so the following spring, he sent me some of those seeds. And those are the ones I've been working with ever since.
Oh my gosh. That's so cool. And then you roped in a few other farmers as well. This is not just a project that just involves the two of you anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. It's kind of evolved to become a farmer-led research project through the EFAO, which has been great because it's meant some kind of organizational support. They're super good at just keeping us all talking to each other and touching base and taking notes and kind of formalizing things in a really beneficial way. So we now have another grower in Manish's area and two other growers up in my area. So I guess there's 5 of us at this point.
And what does that process look like in terms of farmers saving seeds on their own farm? Are you sharing them at all between farms? What's the goal at this point in the process?
I think we have been like very open, like in terms of like what we have a very broad goal. So like people can choose at their farm, like what to produce and select for. I just share the seeds, but I'm selecting my own generations for my selection. And I have like 5 different selections that I've done so far. And I'm choosing to regrow a population which has diversity from all these farmers, actually just from Eva and the one nearby. Hopefully like I can get more selection from the other farmers in North Bay and see what can happen.
Yeah, overall I would say that the project goal is to develop an early ripening delicious melon that we can all reliably grow in our various locations. using the very, like, you know, in the ways that we grow them. So we're all different. Some farms are seed producing farms, some are market gardens. I do a bit of both. And so we all do things differently with different overall goals and capacities. And so we just really wanted to let each farm figure, yes, make the selections to produce a melon that works, or a melon population that works well for them. So we have shared some seeds across the sites, but also we're curious to see, as we replant our own seeds each year, how the different populations develop and change.
Yeah, that is super interesting, given the really different climates that you're growing these all in. When we were speaking before, or actually just emailing back and forth while this idea for an episode was being cooked up, Evelisa, you said that one of the most exciting parts of this project is its collaborative nature. I was just wondering if you wanted to add to that at all.
I think ultimately the collaborativeness of this project makes it way better than it would be if we were all trying to do something like this on our own. It's also way more fun and way more interesting. But I mean, even just from the get-go, Manish sent me seeds. You know, if I had had to do an initial cross myself, I probably would have spent years kind of agonizing over like how to do that and what seeds do I source and blah, you know. So I feel like we all just have different strengths and skills and knowledge bases, and we're able to kind of share that and help each other in kind of this broadly shared goal, which, and I think also we're all very curious about this and specific things in general too, right? Second, there is one other thing I was thinking about. Oh, just how like we're all so different in how we do things and what we know. And so are the melons, right? So like, I think of this as a collaboration between all these different farm sites, but also we're like really collaborating with these plants, because we're not telling them what to do. We're saving seeds from the ones that seem happiest to be growing in our gardens and planting those out next year. And they're kind of doing their thing and telling us maybe what they need or what works for them or what doesn't. And so I really love that element of it too.
Yeah, I love the way that you describe that of collaborating with the melons as well. I think it's something that I've observed from talking with you both in this episode and just in separate conversations, is that you both seem to have a lot of respect for sort of the magic of seed breeding, or that little bit of unpredictability of the seeds coming with their own, you know, genetic background and kind of in some ways their own agency to grow out, how they're going to grow out and all of that. Maybe Manish, you can talk a little bit about how seed breeding is a way that you get to connect with nature.
The whole thing about seeds, why I started doing this was like to find a connection with nature, you know, and it has been a journey since then to like, what does it mean to relate to nature, you know, and how do I relate to nature and what does it mean, you know, and in my own life, when I was choosing seed work to be my life purpose, like it came from a place of like a culmination of all I have been in my life, you know. I was a software engineer before my previous seed saving life, you know, and that work wasn't meaningful to me, you know. So it's like switching from that and finding something which is meaningful and selecting something like which also relates to my own history of like where my parents have been seed savers in their life, you know. And so it is like a culmination of everything that's happening to me, you know. So when I started this, in my first year, I had like 3 plots of all kinds of things you can think of. Cauliflower, cabbage, carrots, beans, anything you can think of, I planted. Even like apple tree and some random things, you know. That's how it starts, you know. And then I planted in one of the plots, I planted like just beans. And these are beans from like bulk barn, you know. And I planted them as a food crop. I didn't expect to like save seeds from them, but I did save seeds. And I got a cross from previous generation that it may have crossed, you know, and that cross was like a beautiful, amazing bean, like a purple, cosmic looking, you know. For me, that was like a gift from nature. That's my relationship that I choose to perceive that, you know, perceive as. And that was like, okay, like, that's amazing. Like, that made me like excited to like see what more is possible in this exploration, you know, and that inspired me to like try watermelon and try melon and try cucumbers and like see like what else nature would give me in that context, you know? So that has been my relationship.
I think something else that's kind of both have touched on is like seed breeding can seem really intimidating, perhaps. Like it's something that has a very exact science, and it's like there's people who have the knowledge to do that, and then there's everyone else. But I love this idea of sort of chipping away at that like ivory tower that sometimes like seed breeding is kept on, that anyone who grows food can grow seeds, and kind of allowing that like a little bit of experimentation and exploration of that. And I think, Evelisa, that was one of the reasons you said you were interested in breeding a Landrace specifically. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
I loved, you know, after listening to Joseph's description and doing a little bit more reading about it, I loved how approachable this seed breeding technique seemed. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, essentially, Landrace seed breeding is like millennia old, and it's how food crops were initially domesticated. Folks saved seeds from the plants that they liked the best, and they replanted them the next year. And that's essentially what we're doing in this project, and what Landrace breeding is it's taking the seeds from the plants that you like the best, and you get to be the decider of what that means, like what is the best, what's your favorite, and replanting them and not worrying about things like uniformity. The parameters just get to be your own. And then it also just lets the plants do their thing and gives them the freedom to thrive, you know, and maybe they need to have slightly bigger leaves or slightly smaller flowers or whatever those adaptations are that the plants need. They have still that genetic diversity to, like you said earlier, like they have the agency to make those changes and adapt as needed. As a technique that's like really approachable, you don't need to worry about cross-pollination or necessarily minimum populations in the same way. You don't need to be taking really minute, intricate measurements and detailed observations at every step along the way to make sure that you're not hand-pollinating. Like there's a lot of these more daunting, time-consuming, really valuable in other contexts. But to do what we wanted to do, this was a way to do it without needing to do all of that. And as somebody that doesn't have a background in seed breeding, Landrace breeding seemed much less daunting and like so much room for curiosity, right? Yeah. Just like Manish said, you know, with his beans, he just let that funny bean plant be and saved those seeds and didn't go, oh, you're different, you get roped out, you know? Yeah. He can kind of replant those beans and keep following that curious thread through the garden and through time. So it feels like there's just more room to play and explore, which to me felt less intimidating.
Like I'd like nature is evolving continuously. Like there's like no stop to where it will stop, you know? So it's like as human explorers, like with the essence of that like adventure, like I think like we can know like what's happening with nature, like so it's like if we are observant of like, and I think that's how we like can relate deeply and commune with nature, you know? So it's like I just let the stories see where the story is evolving, like as much as conscious breeders we can like choose and select, but it's like we do that and that's okay in some context, you know, in the context of like how we relate to our food. Like I think like there's more we can do, and that's how we have always done it. The institutions we have of breeding and this breeder like job, like it's like it came after, like, but we have been doing breeding for generations and millennia. Like we selected like from wild mustard, like all these species of like broccoli and cauliflower and kale and whatnot, you know. So it's like, and we can still keep doing that. We don't have to like stop. We don't have to like assign a person to or a job to do this job. You know? It's like we can still like keep selecting and keep like learning the story of how it's evolving conditionally. So it's like we have to like make it obvious, because it is obvious, you know? So it's like how like we have been programmed to see breeding as like something like a specialized skill. It's like that can be, but like it can also can be as like something very basic. Like, hey, if you're observing to nature, it will teach us, you know?
Mm-hmm. I love the idea of like the plants leading us on this adventure. Like you called it an adventure, Manish, and it's so true, right? Like yep. You're on a mango melon adventure. Yes. We all kind of are now because of you.
Yeah, what is the storied mango melon?
So from the selection, when I planted the first generation of 22 watermelons, I got like in that population, I got hundreds of watermelon. So that like fall was like, I was tasting watermelon like breakfast, one in breakfast, one in lunch, one in,
oh my God.
Like, I tasted watermelon for like weeks. It's quite the adventure. So one of the watermelon like tasted like mango, you know? So in that, like, I'm from India, so like I grew up like tasting mangoes. We have the best mangoes, you know? So it's like, I miss mangoes, you know? And like, when I was tasting this watermelon, like, the texture of this watermelon was just like mango, and it tasted like mango. I was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, how can it be possible that I can taste mango in a watermelon? I was really excited to like see that it just came out of like, just tasting all different kinds and selecting. And from the selection, I'm like, okay, I want to grow this kind. But it's like, the story of watermelon is a very sad story for now. We'll see like what it will evolve to. But like the sad story is like, that year, when I was saving watermelon seeds, I hung them with all the watermelons. I had like maybe like 50 different kinds of watermelons because I was selecting and writing down what each type is and what are the traits and stuff. And out of all those 50, just like mango watermelon, the like mouse went to eat that specific seed. It's like, what? So, and it happened twice now. Mm-hmm. I gave those watermelon seeds because I didn't have time and energy to regrow it. And only 8 seeds were saved. So I saved those 8 seeds. I'm like, okay, this is very, very sacred seeds for me. So I saved those seeds. I kept a few and I gave a friend a few and she grew it. And same thing happened to them. Mouse ate the seeds. So I don't have the mango watermelon seeds anymore, but like I have the parent population. So I'm growing out the parent population this year and hoping that the mango watermelon will be found and saved again. So.
Oh my God, that is an epic tale. I'm like so emotionally invested now. It's like this man's going to find his mango melon.
I love feeling too like up here on part of the hunt for you, Manish, you know, yes. We're all kind of keeping our eyes open for that mango melon to pop out of our populations because we're all working with that same genetic mix, right?
That's tragic, but it's also, I love just even hearing stories like that. It's so fun to be able to like put a face and a story and a name to these things that we're eating because food is so much more than just nutrients. Like food is joy and culture and connection and all of these things. And I think both of you have like a really strong awareness of that and like bring it into your seed breeding, which is so cool to see.
It's really fun. And I love with these melons every year planting the seeds out and then not, you know, as opposed to going to the store and buying a pack of great watermelon seeds, but you have the description on the packet, you know how many days to maturity more or less, you know what to expect. And with this land race, but with any land race, really what you can hope to expect is that it's going to taste good and it's going to do well and you'll get kind of a stable yield from it. But anything else is like, yeah, a surprise, an adventure. It keeps you curious and interested, or it keeps me curious and interested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think like these stories are very important to share because this is like what will make us connect deeply with each other, like, and how we relate with food, you know, because it's like, we have lots of stories of food. Like when we think about tomatoes, we think about like this like bland tasting tomato in the story, you know? It's like, that's not the story to remember or be excited about, you know? I think like as a society, like we will have to like reimagine how we relate to food, you know? We have to like reimagine like what is food to us? Like where does it come from and who is growing it? And like, I think like it is changing in our culture and it will deepen our understanding of food more and we'll connect more deeply with these stories, you know? So it's like, I'm very excited to like walk on this journey and see other people like walk with me and walk with themselves and walk with all their customers, like with ever and other people, you know? So it's like so exciting.
Mm-hmm. Elisa, you were telling me before, or I've caught wind before of your master's thesis. In addition to being a farmer and a producer, you're also a student right now. And from what I've understood, farmers, they have a lot of free time. Students also have a lot of free time. So it seems like a natural pairing. But I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your master's thesis and what you're working on, because it does relate to this project.
My research is looking at how land race breeding intersects with health from an eco-social perspective, or like an eco-social approach to health. So an eco-social approach to health is one that kind of considers not just the health of the individual, but the health of communities, the health of like human communities, but also non-human communities, plants, animals, even abiotic parts of the planet, and just recognizing that like we are all interconnected and we all influence each other, and that we all depend on each other to be able to be healthy for our own health and well-being. And so an eco-social approach to health really, you know, from that perspective, what we need to be healthy right now is a reevaluation of how we think of things and how we do things and how we see our place in the world, which is like a lot of the stuff Manish was just talking about, you know, reimagining how we relate to our food and to nature. And so I'm curious about how this project ties in with that and how it can support that, and trying to just wedge in a little space in the academic conversation around health and food, you know, just kind of getting a little word in edgewise about like, well, land race breeding is a really interesting thing that I think can also support these goals.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm looking at. And specifically, I'm doing my research on this watermelon project. So it's really fun to get to engage with it really practically, like as practically as you can, like literally hands in and on the ground, eating watermelon, like Manish said, morning, noon, and night, every day, so many watermelon smoothies.
Oh my gosh.
Then also kind of approaching it from this more academic perspective and kind of stepping back a few feet and seeing, trying to understand and see the place that this practical work can fit in kind of the world outside of our farms, our seed community, our customers.
That is so, so cool. A few years ago, I was working for Farm Folk City Folk out in Vancouver, and they do such awesome work. They do this citizen science seed trial, so like different varieties of different tomatoes or beets, turnips. The first year that I started working for them, it was watermelons, and one of the varieties was Manish's 22 variety mix. So it was so funny. This was also like an opportunity for a lot of people to collaborate and to, you know, give their feedback and to work with this mix. And 3 years later, I'm encountering this in another way. And these watermelon seeds, they managed to weasel their way into my life in like a few different ways. But it's cool because it speaks to the community of people who are working on these things, and that it is like so much more powerful when there's other folks who are involved. So that's very, very cool to me.
It's funny you're talking about the seeds weaseling their way around, and kind of, I don't know, I just, the funniest thing just happened today on my way home. So we have a little self-serve veggie stand at the end of the driveway, and this time of year I load it up with watermelons. And folks get really excited and they come and they get their veggies and they grab a watermelon or whatever they want. And we just have a mailbox that they just throw their payment in whenever they feel like it. And sometimes folks leave me notes and it's really sweet. Mm. And today I peeked in there and I found this really sweet homemade little envelope package with cutout watermelon pictures from probably like a Safeway catalog taped on. And like pink marker, and somebody wrote seeds, and then inside was three little packets of seeds, one labeled red, one labeled orange, and one labeled yellow. And so some kids down the road had saved their seeds from the melons that they had gotten at the veggie stand like last week or sometime not too long ago, and returned me some seeds.
Oh my gosh, that is amazing.
It's just the sweetest thing, because I think that wouldn't normally happen. It's not an everyday occurrence in my life, at least. And I just love to think that these kids down the road are getting engaged with seed saving.
Yeah, literally, you made that connection for them. Or like they, because of the food that you were able to give them, they saw that like, yeah, these seeds aren't just like to be spit out, that these are actually valuable in and of themselves. Like they hold the whole secret for the whole next generation.
It was so sweet. And like the time and attention they took to like make these little homemade envelopes for them is just so sweet.
That's so lovely. You kind of touched on it a little bit before, but I know there's going to be a lot of people interested in really like the technical aspects of how you started with this 22 variety cross. And I was hoping you could tell me a little bit more about that initial process.
Yeah. So like, I think like whenever I think about breeding, like my view is like we should create the platform and let nature do its work, you know, it will minimize our like work of hand pollinating. And so my objective was just set the platform. So I chose the varieties in a way that were very diverse, and overall scope in the beginning was very broad. If I think back, I selected about maybe 7 open pollinated varieties. There were like about 5 or 6 hybrid, and then they were like tetraploids and diploid, and all the other was diploids. And we were hoping to also make like some triploids from the population. So that means like diploids are two chromosome, tetraploids are 4 chromosome, and triploids are 3 chromosome. So most of the population, which are open pollinated and hybrids, they were diploids. And my friend who had requested from Gene Bank were tetraploids population. So from those tetraploids, we were hoping to make triploids watermelon. They were seedless watermelon, no? So we are hoping to have all genetic diversity that is possible with watermelon, no? So it's like, I planted it, and then we let nature like do the pollination through the bees. And then I wanted to see like what diversity came about from that, you know? So I had to like make sure like my neighbors weren't growing watermelon. So I had like at least a mile separation from where I was growing. I was growing like this at a community farm, and I had a 1 acre plot there separate from other people. And from that, I was able to like make sure like only these 22 melons were crossing with each other.
And yeah, this like one cross has sort of lived on in a lot of different ways, it seems. It's one big experiment.
And like continue to evolve, which is really neat. And Manish and I were talking about this kind of evolution of the populations earlier this summer too. And because we have such a short growing season up here. And so I've really been focusing on selecting and saving and planting out seed from the first 25 great tasting melons that I managed to harvest. And it occurred to me, I think Manish had already been thinking this way, but that by doing it this way, I'm definitely, you know, the facilitating the plants or letting the plants kind of evolve to be earlier maturing, but potentially losing some interesting genetics that would show up in later maturing plants. And really, the difference between the harvest date of the first melon and the last melon is like maybe 10 days up here. So I don't know how big a difference that would make, but down in the Ottawa area, they have a longer growing season. So thinking, you know, looking forward and thinking about sharing seeds between the sites and possibly just making sure that I get to reintroduce some of those later season genetics that might be lost by our short growing season up here is like another really neat thing that we can do because we're working collaboratively. If I was just doing it up here, those, you know, genetics that were maybe part of the original population are gonna be lost.
I'll give an example. Like in my population, there's one called ancient watermelon. They are like very large watermelon. They're grown in the south very much. And because I planted my watermelon late this year, so my watermelon is only getting like 60 days of maturity time. So I'm seeing like the ancient population is not producing watermelons yet, but they have produced to me in previous generations. So like, I know like there is in my gene pool, there is like long watermelons. And I remember like the first generation when I was tasting all this watermelon, there was this like massive watermelon. It was pink. It didn't get to like mature its sweetness. So like, I know like there is a gene in my population that will produce like a massive watermelon in Ottawa climate. But there isn't enough time, but like, I'm hoping to like keep growing and trying to see like if I can have that big producing watermelon. I was hoping like that big producing watermelon will be produced by Eva in her zone, you know?
So. Well, the first year I got a really big one. Not the first year, but the first year I only got 8 melons out of 200 plants. But the following year, I got a lot more melons. And one of them was really big.
Mm-hmm.
But this year I've noticed that on the whole, the melons are getting smaller. They're kind of, well, there's less diversity in size, I would say. And I got a handful of like pretty big round ones, but I didn't get any big oblong or oval ones this year. So anyways, it's just interesting seeing the changes and evolutions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I remember like growing David's Gazelle watermelon. He gave me his F4 population my first year when I was growing these watermelons. And I remember like in his population, the size was going down. And I noticed like the seed size were also going down. So I was like, maybe like there is a dominant gene that is like causing it to have small seeds and small watermelon. So I'm like mindful of that. So like I do want in my population at least like a big watermelon. So at least like there is still a genetic diversity. So I'll plant them again next year with my parent population and the new population and regrow it, and then they will recross and hopefully like we'll have bigger genes in the population as well. So.
It's so fun with this. It's like this kind of a never-ending story in a way. I'm already thinking about next year and like what are these ones going to look like in one season or three seasons or 10 seasons. And it's fun to think about the way that the story keeps going.
Yeah, and I mean, being somebody who knows absolutely nothing about actual watermelon genetics, it's really, and like basically I have like grade 11 biology from 100 years ago to draw on in terms of genetic knowledge. It's interesting to see things happening in the population. Like a few years ago, I also grew, in addition to Manish's cross, I grew a variety of melon that had a yellow and ripe gene in it. So the plants would turn yellow, the melons turn yellow when they're ripe. So it's really handy.
Yeah.
Because you know when they're ripe. I didn't love that melon though, so I didn't save any of the seeds from it. Figured there might be some crossing, figured that also probably wasn't the end of the world. Planted the seeds out the following year, and I didn't have any yellow and ripe. So I just was like, oh, I guess they didn't cross. They were at opposite ends of the garden. That was enough space. This year, I had four plants that had melons that turned yellow when they were ripe.
Nice.
Right? So that's like, okay, so my grade 11 biology tells me that that gene is probably recessive, and that it just showed up this year. But it's just neat to see that even after a few years and getting to know the population, new things are popping out. Like the other thing that happened for the first time this year is I got a white melon, like a white flushed melon, which I hadn't seen yet. Like I'd never seen before. I cut it open and I was like, oh, it's not ripe. And then I tasted it and I was like, you're ripe.
Nice.
It's just white.
That's really exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I have like five population, like, I'm growing, and one is like red orange color, one is salmon, one is early from all my population, and one is like white. So like I'm excited to like see like what that white will give me. It comes from like Citra population that is white, and it's a wild watermelon. So I'm hoping like if it can grow in northern climate, that's very exciting because it can give us white watermelon. And
right,
yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Citron's white flushed. I had forgotten about that. Mm-hmm. And that was in the cross, right?
Yeah, yeah. Maybe the white watermelon is very recessive because it comes in like later maturity time, because I had a big watermelon which was white, but it wasn't sweet. The watermelon wasn't sweet. You know? So I assume like it only comes in later population when there's longer maturity time for it. Mm.
Do you ever get sick of watermelon?
I didn't get sick, but like it was too much watermelon tasting. I'm gonna have same year this year, so you guys are welcome to come and eat the watermelons.
Yeah, I'm. Ironically enough, I'm not a huge fan of watermelon. I feel like a little bad saying that. My grandfather was of the mind that watermelons taste like dirty dish rags, which is so specific. And I think he was hurt by a watermelon. But sometimes I agree. So I think I just need to try it. I haven't met the right melon. So yeah. I think maybe this fall I'm going to need to come to Manish's farm and then just sample until I find the Steph variety that then you can grow out indefinitely for me, yes, and I would be your main customer.
I'm sure he, yes, would love that. Yes. Pull out a melon for him.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could ever get sick of watermelon, but I certainly have more than I can handle.
Oh my gosh.
And it's funny that you mentioned that you're not a huge watermelon fan, because one of the growers who's worked on this project up here is not a fan of watermelon at all. He says he doesn't have a problem with the flavor, but he's not really a fan of the texture.
Yeah, I would say that's where I stand on it too. The texture, sometimes it has to be so fresh. As soon as it gets like a little bit mealy, I'm like, ugh.
Yeah. I think when I was selecting for watermelons, like, I noticed that, like, in the first population, diverse population, I noticed like there were many meaty ones, but like that meat was like very like, what's the word you use?
Mealy.
Mealy, yeah, mealy. And I was selecting for the one with like smooth textures and with fresh tasting, you know? So mm-hmm. My watermelons do have the texture that you may like. So you have to come. Nice.
Very good. You're really sweetening the deal here. That's awesome.
So that raises a very important question to ask. Is it like, who is choosing these varieties, and mm-hmm. who are these people who have the right to like choose what should be on our food plate, you know? So it's like, it's a very important question to like think about, because it's like, okay, somebody is controlling food. Somebody is like making sure like the kind of watermelon we get on a plate, you know? So it's like, should we allow that? Should we have the freedom to like choose like what gets into our table and what it is and how it's selected? So it's like, and that's where I think like it's important to like know like there is an option that is like by growing and selecting, you know, and we can do that in our own gardens. It doesn't need to be like a complicated process to like source, and like I'm happy to share my seeds. So like in that context, like I think it's important question to ask like how and why and where it comes from, and can we participate, you know, or not. Mm-hmm.
It's so true, Manish, and it's not even an obvious question.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. I don't think it's a super obvious thing to think like, oh, it could be different. This is all I've ever seen or known or had access to. And why does Steph need to eat mealy watermelons?
Why?
Just because they ship well and they hold well at the grocery store.
Actually, I remember the story now. There was a customer who came by this past plant sale, and they were looking for a white watermelon that was citron. And she told me that like she, in her culture, they pickle this watermelon. They pickle the skin of the watermelon, no? So it's like, and I didn't know about that people do that, you know, that they pickle watermelon skin and eat it, you know? And she was really excited that like I had those seeds and that like I was growing those seeds, you know? So that's a story.
I love this idea of like democratizing our food, because in general, I think we're moving so much in the opposite direction, that things are becoming more and more homogenous. And as people, we are not super homogenous. Like, we have all of these beautiful quirks and diversities. And without getting too much on my soapbox, it's like so beautiful that someone can come along and see something in a plant that someone else might not even notice or like care about particularly. But for them, it's important, and it's something that they like is meaningful for them. So I'm definitely with you both in the sense of wanting to open those doors wider and invite people in to just try their hand and to experiment and to lean into their curiosity and see where it goes.
It's also just so lovely to think that we're leaving, or, you know, that anybody can leave room for plants to just be who they need to be too, and do what they need to do to thrive. And that, you know, when you're talking about just how everything's becoming so homogenized and uniform, and that uniformity takes a toll, right? So leaving space for diversity,
mm-hmm.
I mean, in any context, but we're talking about watermelons in the garden right now, like is so valuable. And well, it's also really inspiring, mm-hmm. because of what comes of it, right?
Yeah. Like, I want to reflect upon like the nature of our project is like, it's so diverse, you know. It's like each of the participants who are participating, they all have different goals, you know. And like that diversity itself is like amazing, you know. And like the whole collaborative piece, that even though there's so much diversity among us, we are able to like collaborate in a way which is like meaningful for all of us. You know? So it's like, I think like that tells a story of like how beautiful it can be to like weave this together, you know? And like, even though we have different tastes and different like selection processes and different ways we like live lives, but at the same time, we can work together in a common thread of like beautiful, we can weave this so beautifully, you know?
This has been really, really great, you two. Thank you so much for all of your insights and for sharing your stories and your knowledge. And it, conversations like these could like make my heart grow a little bit. It's so meaningful to remember like why we're doing this work. It's so much more than just the chromosomes and looking at the genetics of this and that and yield and vitality and all these things that are important, but there's like more to it than that. And this conversation has really been reinvigorating for me in that way. So thank you both so much for taking the time.
Thanks so much for talking to us. It's very inspiring to like hear these stories with you and with everyone.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. And I mean, it's not all the time that we run into people that we can talk about watermelons with, these ideas with. So it's been really nice to have this opportunity.
Seedheads is produced by the Bauda Family Initiative on Canadian Seed Security, a program of Seed Change, whose main office is located on the traditional, unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabeg people. To find episode transcripts and learn more about seed work in Canada, please visit seedsecurity.ca.